You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of December 2011 on Monocle 24. And a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next 60 minutes, we ask the man who saved Polaroid about whether Kodak has had its moment. We talk to a group who are creating a version of the Arctic by the River Thames here in London, and we get the Idiot's Guide to Credit Ratings Agencies. All that and a mix of the best music. That's coming up in the next hour, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. A suicide attack killed dozens of Shiite Muslims at a crowded Kabul shrine today, and four died in a smaller blast in a key northern city in the worst sectarian violence Afghan has seen since the fall of the Taliban. Bodies and blood were scattered down a street in the heart of the capital, where a crowd of hundreds had gathered to mark the festival of Ashura. At least 55 were killed and 160 wounded, some critically. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, speaking in Berlin, said the attacks were unprecedented.
We all wish the best for those who are injured and quick recovery, and patience to the families of those who have lost their dear ones.
A European Union watchdog said it was investigating credit rating agencies to look at how they rank sovereign bonds and other debt, and could impose heavy sanctions if it finds any wrongdoing by the influential institutions. The exercise takes on increased significance after Standard & Poor's said it may downgrade the ratings of 15 Eurozone countries, a move that rattled markets ahead of a summit of EU leaders on Friday to tackle the debt crisis. Moritz Kramer is Standard & Poor's Managing Director.
It's not our role to give concrete advice. Our role is to analyse and name the risks and tell investors how we see the risks as early as we change our opinion. That's exactly what we have done.
Opposition leaders defied the Russian authorities today by organising a second mass protest in 2 days against Vladimir Putin's 12-year rule, despite warnings of a police crackdown and the jailing of one of the organisers. Using social media, such as Twitter and Facebook, they summoned supporters to a rally in Moscow 1 day after 5,000 people protested in the capital over alleged vote rigging in Sunday's election and demanded an end to Putin's rule. Opposition leader Vladimir Ryzhkov said there was little democracy involved.
About 10-15% of votes were the result of ballot box stuffing, falsifications and rewriting of the ballot papers. The real result for United Russia is no more than 35%, maybe even less than that.
Democratic transition in Syria means more than just removing President Assad, US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said in Geneva, where she spoke with members of the Syrian opposition today. Hillary Clinton met seven Syrian opposition members from the Syrian National Council in a gesture of support for them in the face of an eight-month crackdown by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The US ambassador to Syria will return to Damascus later today, 6 weeks after he was withdrawn because of threats to his safety. UN officials say Syria is close to civil war. There are also fears that sectarian divisions could deepen the conflict, as happened in recent years in neighbouring Iraq. Available reports offer only a partial explanation of who stood behind the kidnapping and murder of over 60 Syrians whose bodies were dumped yesterday in two separate places in Homs. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights quoted a witness in Homs as saying he saw the bodies of 34 people who were originally kidnapped earlier today by Shabha from the neighbourhood uprising against the regime. Shabha is a popular name for state-backed paramilitaries drawn from Assad's minority Alawite sect, who are outnumbered about 8-1 by Syria's Sunni Muslim people. And finally, the number of rhinos poached in South Africa has risen sharply this year, with more than 400 killed, according to the South African National Parks. South Africa is home to 90% of Africa's white rhino population. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel. And in Europe, cold winds are sweeping western parts of the continent through Tuesday and Wednesday, particularly in France, Belgium and Holland. Rain showers with the wind too. In the Alps, it's turned much colder. Resorts are opening and it'll be snowing until Thursday, half a metre in some places. The best weather at the moment is around the Costa del Sol and generally Spain. Here's Wednesday's city forecast. In London, 8 Celsius, sunny and a cold wind. In Brussels, 8 degrees with rain. Vienna, 4 Celsius with showers. In Barcelona, 14 degrees and sunny. Air travel, the jet stream will be absolutely howling over UK airspace for about 48 hours, peaking 300 kilometres an hour, potential for particularly bad turbulence flying out west at 30,000 feet. North America, rain and snow for the Atlantic seaboard, so umbrellas needed in Washington, D.C., and a risk of some troublesome snow across parts of the northeast of the United States as well. Later in the week, though, across much of America, it gets cold, dry and sunny. Wednesday's city forecast. Philadelphia, 11 Celsius and rain. Chicago, 1 degrees and sunny. Las Vegas, 13 Celsius, but below zero at night. San Diego, 16 Celsius with a chilly breeze. And a look at destinations further east now. The weather looking changeable over Japan in the coming days. Often cloudy and chilly with rain too. In Tokyo, it's 11 Celsius on Wednesday and cloudy. In Osaka, 14 degrees and partly cloudy. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Thomas. The time is coming up to 7 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jo kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, and we begin today's show with the latest cinematic offering from Italy. Habemus Papam is the tale of a cardinal who, against his will, has greatness thrust upon him and is elected Pope.
Your last movie, We Have a Pope, is out in theatres here in London, and my first question is more a clarification. Is this really a film about the Vatican?
Beh, è un film sul mio Vaticano, insomma, non... È un film su un uomo, è un film su un uomo in un particolare momento della sua vita.
This is a movie about my Vatican. This is a movie about a man in a particular segment of his life.
Così fa i conti con le proprie fragilità e proprio in questo momento.
Because he's old and because he has to face his own fragility and is expected to take over a very high responsibility role. The whole film is about the conflict between the role he's called to represent and his own doubts, his own uncertainty.
Tutto interno a lui tra così il compito che è stato chiamato ad assumere e però il fare i conti con la propria.
This is not a movie about Vatican in 2011 or in the 2000s, not in a realistic way.
Incertezze, ecco, quindi non è un film sul Vaticano del 2011 o degli anni 2000, insomma, non in maniera realistica.
In Britain, many newspapers have published comments about your film. It looks like the British press is disappointed by a lack of criticism against the Vatican.
Allora, se uno ha già deciso che cosa deve essere un film, è inutile che va a vederlo qua. Che senso ha fare una critica a un film dicendo non.
If you have already decided what the film should be about, there is no point in watching it. What is the point in criticizing a film by saying that it doesn't mention any of the serious issues confronting the Vatican or the nation?
Veramente un ritorno indietro a discorsi proprio da anni 50. Questo è incredibile.
There is a regression of good taste, not repression, but a real regression. We are going back to the 50s cultural atmosphere, and this is incredible. Any serious director would never, than a realistic movie about the Vatican mentioning its financial scandals and pedophilia. But I am a serious director who didn't want to do a realistic movie.
Ma spesso i film di denuncia non sono film di inquietudine per lo spettatore, ma sono di rassicurazione.
Often the so-called social films do not create anxiety in the public. They are just meant to reassure. Do you have your ideas? I will repeat them. Do you only know five things about a topic? I will re-narrate them again and over again. My film is not like that. It is not a realistic movie. Do I really need to explain that in my film? I won't accept it. I put a lot of efforts in my films. But few people, even among the public, realize the attention to details and the care I put into them.
Si accorgono della cura, dell'attenzione.
It is true that the church has lost credibility, and I never thought it had credibility. But I can do a detached film about the Catholic Church, because I am not in conflict with an institution who does not represent me.
That was the director of Habemus Papam, Nanni Moretti, talking to Monocle earlier on today. Well, to get what the reaction is like in Italy, I'm joined on the line by Robert Mickens. He's a Rome correspondent for The Tablet, the weekly Catholic magazine. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Robert. Have you seen the film?
Yes, I've seen the film, and I found it quite delightful. And I have to say, I thought that Nanni Moretti was actually quite respectful of the Vatican. I mean, in some ways, it's a farcical film. There are some scenes which are quite funny and unbelievable in that sense. But otherwise, I thought that the film was respectful in that it did not attack the church in any way, make fun of the church in any way. But kind of, I thought what was really endearing about it was this dilemma that the man who was elected pope faced, and the psychology of his having to face his election to this impossible task.
It is unusual that there's a psychiatrist in this film, isn't there? And it's humanizing a figure who the Italians have been, well, the whole Catholic Church indeed has been looking up to, and must look up to, it doesn't it?
Well, Nanni Moretti himself plays the psychiatrist in this film initially, and then his ex-wife in the film, who's also a psychiatrist, then meets with the man who's elected pope. I think that this did, rile some people that thought, you know, you can't treat the pope, the Holy Father, as some mere mortal. I mean, you often hear people in the Vatican, even today, speak in these terms, as the director himself said, like the 1950s environment of calling the Pope a sacred person. Well, my God, we believe as Christians, as Catholics, that every person is sacred, and that the Pope is no more sacred than anyone else. He has a particular role, a very important role in the life of the community. But now I think that the way the subject was treated in the Moretti film, Habemus Papam, was actually quite fun and respectful overall.
You say it's fun, respectful, and endearing, but nonetheless, it's the was it the Italian newspaper Avvenire called for a boycott of the film? Why do you think there is a reaction like that now?
Actually, it's very interesting. There was a letter to Avvenire by an Italian journalist, one of my colleagues, who wrote in, who was incensed at the film and thought that it was disrespectful, and he was the one in a letter to the editor who urged people to boycott the film. But Vatican Radio, on the other hand, had an editorial that praised it pretty favorably, and so did a couple of other Catholic publications in the country. So I think that what we have, we also see that there's a difference in the Catholic community, not just in Rome and in Italy, but I think throughout the world, where you have some Catholics who have a much more exalted idea of authority in the church, and the Pope in particular, and others who have a much more fraternal notion of the members of the church being brothers and sisters, and without diminishing at all, of course, the importance of the role of ministers and the hierarchy.
And what do you think has brought about this gradual change? Because it was just a couple of decades ago, that films like The Life of Brian, people were being accused of being blasphemous, but they said, no, we're not being blasphemous, we're simply being heretical. How has this change come about?
Well, first of all, I have to say that this is in no way like The Life of Brian, which was much more a satire. on the whole Christ event and belief in one way. I mean, Monty Python is quite different from Nanni Moretti, who is a comic director, but also dealing with serious issues. I think that the whole point of the film Habemus Papam was getting into the mind of you know, somebody who's elected to this very kind of superhuman task for a mere mortal. I think that's the twist in the tale here. I guess that there is a sense among some Christians in this increasingly secularized world, and in a world where the churches as institutions have lost a lot of their authority and their kind of influence on wider society, I think there is a sense among some believers of inferiority or a sense of siege, kind of a siege mentality. And so there's a bristling at anything that touches on faith matters that could be in any way construed as making fun, poking fun, or being disrespectful.
In the interview that we just heard there with the director, Mr. Moretti said that there has been a general regression of good taste in Italy. And it does strike me as quite odd that you would do a film about the human frailty of a pope when Italy is such a hotbed at the moment of much more deep scandals, such as scandals of finances and financial impropriety and paedophilia, as mentioned by Mr. Moretti in his interview just then, and also the great Berlusconi storm. Is there, do you think, still an appetite for a film about a pope who doesn't want to be a pope?
Oh, well, it's interesting. Nanni Moretti actually did a film a couple of years ago about Silvio Berlusconi. Again, it was, but it was very clear it was about, particularly about that person. It was called the Caiman or the Shaman. And it was the charlatan, basically. And it really made fun of Berlusconi. Didn't call him by name, but it was clear, and he even said that was the point. I think that Moretti just likes to get inside the kind of the psychology of a character, likes to develop a character. And Michele Piccoli does a splendid job in playing the Pope who gets elected in this film. I mean, it's extremely touching. I was surprised that people did not find this, could not empathize with this man, this actor who played the Pope, because I thought it was quite, I think it showed the human side of the person of the Pope. And I have to point out that the Vatican made no kind of protest against this. There was some talk that, you know, there are films that are better. It wasn't a masterpiece, but I don't think anybody was offended in the Vatican, and I wonder if Pope Benedict XVI might have even seen the film.
Robert Mickens, thank you very much indeed. That was Robert Mickens, who's a Rome correspondent for The Tablet, that is the weekly Catholic magazine, and I'm sure, no doubt, if he gets the opportunity to ask Pope Benedict what he thinks of the film, he will do. You're listening to Midori House. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Time for a little bit of music, I think, and Little Dragon. That was Little Dragon on Monocle 24 and Looking Glass. You're listening to Midori House with Emma Nelson. The time is 23 minutes past the hour.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world. In London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo. Where you can find a full range of Monocle products, perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
In a little under half an hour here on Midori House, we'll be asking what went wrong with the brand Kodak. But first, we take a quick look to yesterday, when on Midori House, we profiled the world's biggest light festival. That was the Fête des Lumières in Lyon, in France. Well, today, we're going to meet one of London's most innovative art and design practices, called United Visual Artists. UVA say they mix sculpture, architecture and design, and use lights to create their installations all around the world. Their latest project involves recreating an impression of the Arctic Circle in the centre of London at the city's National Maritime Museum. Well, I'm delighted to say that we're joined in the studio today by UVA's creative director, Matthew Clark. Matthew, thank you very much for coming in. Explain to us a little bit about this installation. What's it called and what's it supposed to do?
Thanks for inviting me. The exhibition at the National Maritime Museum is called High Arctic. And we were commissioned to create a work which ultimately conveyed the scale, fragility and beauty of the Arctic, but in a kind of fresh way, in the sense that there's no objects. It's a completely immersive environment. And it's non-linear in a way. What we've created is a landscape, an abstractic Arctic landscape, where the visitors explore using torches that we give out at the entrance.
So it's a profoundly interactive experience.
That's right, yes. We've created a system that tracks the torch hotspots, and therefore we can create wonderful projections from that hotspot, and this turns into an environment to explore.
It seems to be a stark contrast with the actual atmosphere that you generally find inside the Maritime Museum. How did the setting help you decide what you wanted to do?
Well, it was quite a challenge, actually, because it's the first work in the new Sammy Offer wing. So it was a blank canvas in a way. But if you go into the Maritime Museum, it's full of these wonderful artefacts such as navigational devices and boats and in glass boxes and wonderful artifacts from maritime history. But what I think the museum were looking for is a fresh perspective, really. And our work is often, it's virtual in the sense that there are not objects there, and it takes people's interaction in order to bring it to life.
Now, you talk about the fact that this is used pretty much exclusively with light, but mm-hmm. you're combining it with sound. I've read a review somewhere, or maybe this is actually on your own website, where mm-hmm. you say you don't want to do this with a hangover. How do you combine technology to create such a very vivid and immediate experience?
Well, I don't think that was on our website, but... sound, light, projection, these are all ephemeral mediums which we like to combine, and when combining them in the right way, you can create very emotive experiences, and that's really the feeling that we want people to leave the exhibition with, caring a bit about the subject that we're trying to communicate, rather than just presenting dry information and statistics, which are usually presented to scare people to care about a subject such as climate change.
And you're using light to do this. Well, you mainly work in light, don't you? Yesterday we spoke to the Fête des Lumières in Lyon, and they obviously have incredibly cutting-edge installations, which mm-hmm. again is very, very interactive with mm-hmm. with the spectators, with the audience. How are light festivals and light itself as an art form changing in the last few years?
Well, we've shown work at a number of light festivals, such as Nuit Blanche in Paris and in Canada, they are wonderful festivals in the sense that the whole city kind of stops and these wonderful installations take place, and it's very much about the people, bringing people together, and they date back many centuries, actually. But there's all sorts of different advancements. There's a lot of people doing these three-dimensional building projections. They seem to be popular. But in fact, the things that I find interesting are the things that are kind of tucked away, you know, down an alleyway or in the crypt of a church, and not really the big crowd-pleasing things that you tend to see at these festivals.
Nonetheless, you're doing something which is clearly quite crowd-pleasing because it's at such a high-profile place. Very quickly, where are you going to be going next with this, or what will be your next project?
Well, High Arctic is we're aiming to tour that around the world, different institutions. We're also working with a group called the Creators Project. We just showed a large-scale light installation in New York, just beneath the Brooklyn Bridge, which was fantastic just a month ago. And we're trying to take that to San Francisco next month. So there's a number of things in the pipeline, mixture of things. But, you know, we're winding up the year now. 2011 has been incredible. There's lots of things in the pipeline for 2012.
Matthew, thank you very much indeed. That was the creative director of UVA, who's talking about the impression of the Arctic Circle at London's National Maritime Museum. When's it on until, please, Matthew?
It's actually only on for another 2 or 3 weeks. So
okay.
Check the website out.
Thank you very much indeed, Matthew. That was right. Matthew Clark there.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 30 minutes past the hour.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Questo è Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24 è Yorkosa.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumatanelia.
The Bropa Jalabat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Not entirely sure what time it is, though. Nick Kelly has the headlines for us.
Thanks, Emma. A suicide attack killed dozens of Shiite Muslims at a crowded Kabul shrine today, and four died in a smaller blast in a key northern city in the worst sectarian violence Afghan has seen since the fall of the Taliban. The United States called today for a new regime of tolerance and freedom in Syria as forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad battled fighters infiltrating the country to join the growing rebel army trying to overthrow him. Russians took to the streets of Moscow for the second successive day today to demand an end to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's 12-year rule, but riot police blocked their way and hundreds of pro-Kremlin youths tried to spoil the protest. Police fired tear gas at dozens of hooded youths hurling petrol bombs and stones outside Parliament in Athens today, ahead of a vote on the 2012 budget that spells more belt tightening for austerity-hit Greeks. Egypt's new prime minister said today the ruling army would grant him extra powers, the state news agency reported, after critics accused the military of failing to give the last cabinet enough clout. A threat by Standard & Poor's to slash credit ratings across the Eurozone sounded a clarion call today, which could help Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel force through a change to the European Union treaty at a summit on Friday. A car bomb exploded yards from the Turkish embassy in the Somali capital today, the latest in a wave of deadly attacks in the coastal city, and a health official said three people were killed. Iran promised to provide better protection in future for diplomats and said there would be no repeat of the storming of the British embassy last week, which has damaged its already strained relations with Europe. Kuwait's ruler dissolved parliament today and called for an election, according to state media. And rich nations of the OECD have committed $22.9 billion, or 15% of their total official development assistance in 2010, to help poor countries fight climate change. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. 27 minutes to the hour here. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and it's time for a little bit of music. This is João Gilberto. And that was João Gilberto on Monocle 24 with Chin Chin Por Chin Chin. You're back with Midori House. The time is 24 minutes to the top of the hour. And we can now move to the demise, or the possible demise, of Kodak. Has its moment now passed? Recent newspaper articles on the subject have all the feel of a eulogy, the portrait of a once brilliant giant, now just a shutter click from extinction. The estimates are that even if Kodak does avoid bankruptcy, its cash reserves won't last more than a year. The name Kodak no doubt still inspires, but the product is forgotten. So what can be done? Well, to possibly answer that question, I'm joined by Dr. Florian Kapps, the entrepreneur and the saviour of Polaroid. And we also have Rob Riskitzer, the managing editor of the technology website Boing Boing. Florian, we'll start with you. A very warm welcome to Midori House. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Before we talk about what went wrong, let's just enjoy Kodak for a moment. What's made it so great?
I think, you know, there is no doubt that the Kodak brought people a very new technology, and for a long time period, they did everything right. They had a brilliant product, and they had a brilliant setup of offering the people cheap cameras and wonderful film materials. So it really changed the way people could document their lives. So I think for a long period, they did everything perfectly right.
I'll ask the same question of you as well, please, Rob. What do you think made Kodak such a special brand? Oh, we don't seem to have Rob. We will continue with Florian, though, if that's all right, Florian. Just briefly recap, I described you at the top of this interview as the man who saved Polaroid, and we're talking this within the context of what could be done for Kodak. You were really were Polaroid's knight in shining armour, weren't you? Briefly tell us the tale of what happened.
Regarding Polaroid?
Yes.
I think you know, the challenge that all of this company have to face is that everybody's scared about the digital revolution. So the brand, what they did to the brand, and this is the same for Kodak and Polaroid, they grew and they became very well known and appreciated in the analog world. And now they have this digital world, and they don't know exactly how to react to that. And the funny thing, or the delicate thing that happened to Kodak, is that basically they invented, or, you know, they're very, very important part of inventing this digital aspect of photography. So they very much did contribute in their own problems they have now. But the good news is that finally it turned out that the analog and the digital can live together very well, and that there is still a very big analog demand. So I think the biggest problem also for Kodak now is to deal with this perfect with this situation, and to rescale to the right dimension that still the analog aspects of their business has, as well as to find a good way to reposition themselves in the digital age, which they are still searching for.
Is there any room, though, in a digital age now? Should Kodak think more towards the analog? Or are we really talking about a brand which was the brand of its own generation, and we should just happily wave it goodbye and say thank you very much, but you're no longer relevant anymore?
I think they have still a very big chance, and you're still if they're in big troubles. I think they're among the best known and very positive perceived brands in the world. I think the perfect mixture is a combination of exactly this analog aspect and new digital aspects. And, you know, even if it doesn't look too good at the moment, they have an incredible business. They have many millions of customers still believing in the Kodak. They have a strong brand. It just has to be connected to the right messages, I think. And I'm not a specialist in Kodak. I just have learned and spent a lot of time of thinking about the Polaroid past and how to transfer it into the future, and it's a very, very delicate topic, and you know, I'm not the expert to tell about solutions. My feeling is that there still has to be a chance to get the things right by learning from the current situation and the glory past.
I believe we now can be joined by Rob Biskitzer, who's the managing editor of Boing Boing, the technology website. Welcome, Rob. Florian just then said that there was a future for Kodak. You specialise in thinking about technology. What do you think that future might be?
I think the future for Kodak is very likely as a patent litigator. It doesn't make any interesting products. It doesn't have any significant presence in digital cameras or film anymore. Except in making stuff like silver halide papers. And all its prospects are based upon exploitation of its intellectual property, which has been built up over the last 20 or 30 years from having invented and been a consistent innovator of the kind of digital technologies that it hasn't actually been able to exploit very well in terms of its consumer and commercial business.
And we appear to have lost Florian as well. I think not only has Kodak had its moment, but perhaps maybe this interview may well have done. I was talking there to Dr. Florian Kapps, the man who saved Polaroid, and Rob Biscuit, the managing director of Boing Boing. It's 16 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. If you've missed any of your favourite programmes on Monocle.com, tune in or download The Curator, our Sunday roundup of the best of the week's programmes on Monocle 24. With a different editor hosting every week, The Curator is your quick and easy way into the week's stories on Monocle 24. That's The Curator, brought to you in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24, every Sunday at 1300 London time, or via our timeshare player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. In a while, we're going to be talking about credit ratings agencies and why they make everybody quake in their boots. But first, a little bit of music and Grace Jones, I've Seen That Face Before. Grace Jones on Monocle 24. And you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome back. And we turn now to the issue of credit ratings agencies. When Standard & Poor's warned that 15 of the 17 Eurozone countries would have their credit ratings possibly downgraded within the next 3 months, the whole European region went into a spin. Markets fell, leaders defiantly puffed out their chests, and a wave of fresh doubts washed over the Eurozone. But why do credit ratings agencies make everybody quake so much in their boots? Well, to hopefully answer that question and a couple of others, I'm joined in the studio now by Ben Chu, who's the economics editor of the Independent newspaper here in London. A very warm welcome to Midori House. Thank you very much, Ben. So just explain to me the power that these agencies wield.
Credit rating agencies are organisations which give a rating to securities, and by that means government debt or packages of loans, and their role in the financial system is to decide which securities are good credit risks and which are bad credit risks for private investors. When a credit rating agency downgrades a security, that's a sign that it's become more risky, and the effect of that is for private investors to say, well, I don't want to hold that anymore, unless they're particularly keen on having a risky, high yielding investment. So For an investor who wants a very safe risk, a very safe investment, a downgrade will be a sign to get out. And that's what's happened yesterday. By threatening to downgrade the sovereign bonds of France and Germany, which are classic safe risks in a European context, they've created a market panic.
So by saying we think we're going to downgrade you, they can, like you say, create a market panic. But who monitors them? Who monitors the credit rating agency? Or is this simply just a bunch of economists sitting around and thinking, actually, you're a bit of a bad risk, and then just by opening their mouths, creating what could be chaos?
Yes, it's a very good question. Who regulates the regulators, or who regulates the agencies? And the answer is no one. They are effectively a monopoly on deciding who is a good risk and who isn't. And it's especially dangerous because they are effectively paid, well, they are paid by clients. They fund themselves by giving advice to banks and big institutional investors. And this is, they shame themselves, really, in the boom years by telling their clients what they wanted to hear about, you probably remember these toxic securities, securities made up of American subprime mortgages, which they classified as AAA, ultra safe, when they were nothing of the sort. And it's pretty clear that they were leaned on by their clients, by their paymasters, to give them those very strong those very strong ratings.
So that would lead me to the question: is, you know, why do people still trust them? Because they were, like you say, responsible or involved in the subprime problem in the United States. And then we've read recently that the likes of Nicolas Sarkozy is deeply suspicious of credit ratings agencies. Why do people still listen to them then?
I think a lot of people still listen to them out of force of habit, because they've grown up and they've, for all their professional investing lives, they've assumed that the credit ratings agencies know what they're talking about, despite contrary evidence of recent years. They're also listened to because the fiscal and monetary authorities, the central banks, etc., still give these credit rating agencies a privileged position in the hierarchy. So they'll say, we will swap securities for cash to create to inject liquidity into the banking system, etc., by swapping only AAA rated securities. So they're implicitly trusting the judgment of the credit rating agencies by saying that we will swap those securities for cash. So that's another reason why there is why people still care what these organisations think security is worth.
Nonetheless, there are reports recently, I think the European Commission has called for the rules that govern or monitor the credit rating agencies to be more strict. I think the two problems that the Commission pointed out were the fact that they wanted the agency's decisions to be made more transparent, but most importantly, they wanted them to be made accountable for any mistakes they made. What would you say to such a tightening of the operation?
Well, I think in one respect, it would be welcome that there should be more transparency about how these organisations operate, and their, particularly, as I said before, their relationship with their clients. Having said that, I do think the official European desire to find some kind of political motivation in the timing of these downgrades, etc., is fanciful. These downgrades aren't coming because the agencies want to sort of scupper the attempts to rescue the euro. They're coming because the credit ratings agencies are following the decisions of hundreds and thousands of individual private investors who've decided themselves that Italy is not a very good credit risk anymore, that Spain is not a very good credit risk anymore. They're following the markets. They're not leading them. Now, when they follow, it's like an elephant running into a room. You know, it creates a huge force which has knock-on ramifications. But that's not to say that, the elephant is following the other investors, effectively.
Yeah. having said that, though, you talk about elephants following the markets.
Yeah.
Quite brilliantly. Thank you very much indeed. Was it purely coincidental then yesterday that when Standard & Poor's threatened a downgrade, it happened on exactly the same day that the Merkel-Sarkozy treaty proposition was laid on the table, which effectively was a potential long-term solution to the problem?
Well, apparently the Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel already knew that it was coming. So presumably they could have timed their announcement so that didn't fall on the same day. So I'm not so sure that you can actually read into the timing of it and say, look, this was Standard & Poor's trying to sort of torpedo what they announced previously in the day. I think that's still unclear. But as I said before, I don't think there is a conspiracy on the part of the credit agencies to destroy the Eurozone. I think the biggest scandal is the fact that they have proved their incompetence manifestly in recent years, and yet they are still given this privileged position in the hierarchy by the official authorities.
And they can actually be used as an incentive as well to reform, because I think it was the German finance minister today, Wolfgang Schäuble, who said this threat is an incentive for progress to be made by the Eurozone leaders. Very briefly, because I'm afraid we're running out of time, can a ratings agency operate as a carrot, or just as an incentive for people actually to get their house in order?
I think what you saw in Wolfgang Schäuble's comments was a strange strain of German masochism, where they like the fact that the markets are panicking because they feel that this will encourage governments to get their financial houses in order. I think they can be a disciplinary measure, but they have to get it right, and they just simply have not got it right for most of recent years.
And very briefly, what do you think the long-term future for credit agencies is going to be?
Well, I don't know what the long-term future is, but I hope that they will be less privileged players in the market.
Are they generally liked among economists? You give me the impression that you don't like them very much, or people don't like them very much.
I don't think any serious investor pays that much attention to what they say. I think a lot of unconfident ones probably do, and they shouldn't do.
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. That was all from Midori House. Join us at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.